Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. A violation of received protocols today, three guests, three segments, a power trio. Aaron Thompson will talk about the re-sanctification of Confederate memorials. Mouin Rabbani makes a return appearance to talk about Trump's preposterous Gaza peace plan. And Ted Hamm will tell us about Zoran Mamdani. First, the politics of public art. Aaron Thompson was on this show back in 2020, when BLM-inspired demonstrators were pulling down Confederate statues, and again in 2022, when her book Smashing Statues, On the Rise and Fall of Public Monuments, came out. Now that Trump and company are trying to put some of those statues back up, it seemed like a good time to have her back. She's a professor of art crime at John Jay College, City University of New York. Aaron Thompson. 5 years ago, we were pulling down Confederate memorials, and now we're talking about putting them back up. I get that these fights around public monuments are fights about the present, but what, if anything, does all this dickering around monuments accomplish?
Well, fights about monuments are never really fights about a heap of stone. They are about how we understand our past and our future. So the reason that Black Lives Matter's protests coalesced around monuments are they are, as Levi Strauss would say, a thing to think with. You can use them to talk about intangibles of justice and history and honor. So I think Trump is doing pretty much the same thing. I do disagree with you when you said that we're putting them back up, because he has announced that things are going to be put back up. But so far, the administration has been a lot better at deleting things, removing various websites about what they're calling DEI history, et cetera. Not anything has gone back up yet. And it's a lot easier to announce you're going to reinstall something than get the millions and millions of dollars it would cost, say, to put back up the Arlington Confederate Monument. So I am still waiting to see what will actually happen.
You wrote something about that Arlington Confederate Monument. So recall that struggle for us and then where it's going now.
Arlington National Cemetery was segregated, like the armed forces as a whole, until the 1940s. And ironically enough, Confederate soldiers made it in before African American soldiers. So in the 19-teens, there's a movement to dig up some Confederates from a nearby private cemetery and bury them in Arlington, surrounding a huge bronze monument with life-sized frieze of figures celebrating the deathless glory of the South, et cetera, et cetera. And the monument was controversial from the first for featuring two black figures, enslaved people, who were shown as supporting the Confederates. It was part of what is known as the heavy scare quotes, faithful slave myth, where the idea being that black people must have loved being enslaved or else the Confederates could have never fought because they were able to go off and leave their enslaved workforces to take care of the plantations and their babies and et cetera. So all extremely ridiculous. As part of the Department of Defense's decision to remove honorific naming and monuments to the Confederacy, this monument was taken down, not to be melted down, but to be reinstalled elsewhere with historical context. And now Pete Hegseth took to Twitter to announce that he had been victorious over, quote, woke lemmings who wanted to see it taken down, and says it'll go back up. But again, the estimated cost is in the tens of millions, so we will see.
Confederate monuments went up in history at sometimes important points relative to their present. So as I recall from your book, a Confederate monument in Birmingham, Alabama was constructed when there were labor struggles, right? Wasn't it relevant to the struggles of the present and not just a memory of the past?
A lot of people defend Confederate memorials saying that they are a form of mourning, of recognizing the tragedy of the Civil War. But very, very few of the Confederate monuments we have went up in the years immediately after the war. Instead, they went up after the successful imposition of Jim Crow laws. with a huge swath of memorialization. So they're essentially victory monuments for the retaking of the South by white supremacists.
And now that we're revisiting the issue of at least possibly contemplating putting some of these Confederate memorials back up, what does that say about the present moment?
Well, that the Civil War isn't over yet, or at least the essential issues about who should hold power in America and whose lives are worth honoring.
Well, there was white supremacists then. Is it white supremacists again?
I think there is more co-opting of an audience now. If you read the speeches in the newspapers when these monuments went up, there is no pretense that they aren't about white supremacy. In the case of the Birmingham, Alabama monument, which is additionally ridiculous because Birmingham was founded well after the close of the Civil War, so why it needed a Civil War monument? Nobody from Birmingham died because the city did not exist then. But if you read those speeches, which marked the very hasty erection of that monument during a threatened interracial unionization drive and strike by coal miners in the area, those speeches are directed towards the white workers in the audience and saying that your fathers and grandfathers died to fight the hideous specter of threatened racial equity, one of the speakers said. So the message was very clear that these monuments were there to remind white citizens to keep their power and not to align with the other people who are oppressed, not to share the prosperity of America. Nope, it's about we got back into power and we're going to stay here. So now I think many fewer of the people who would say, I don't know, let's keep up these monuments or even let's put them back. I think many fewer recognize the malignancy at their core. They think they're about history. They think they're about the tragedy of the Civil War. But I don't think that's a good enough excuse. You have to, if you're fighting, you claim to defend history, learn what that history really is. Learn why these monuments really went up, what they've been doing this whole time, and what your neighbors think about them, how they're hurting the audiences that are seeing them, as well as making you feel all warm and fuzzy about your Johnny Reb uncle, great-great-great uncle, or whatever.
I know you're not a mind reader, but how do you see what Trump and Hegseth are up to? What are they trying to accomplish with these rememorializations?
I think they are struggling to achieve anything that they've actually promised. And so these are quick victories. They're a way to get positive headlines to rally the base without, again, actually having to do anything because nobody's keeping track of what monuments are actually going up or down. So they're a good way to say the previous administration was wrong. Those of you who were scared by the Black Lives Matter protests, we are on your side somehow retroactively. And it's a victory of images and propaganda rather than actualities.
He wants to add himself to Mount Rushmore. He's speculated about that many times over the years. That's a monument with a very curious history. Could you remind us where it came from?
Sure. I would say, though, I would love to see him add himself to Mount Rushmore because all of the surrounding stone is honeycombed with flaws. So just the spectacle of seeing huge chunks of his face falling off would, I don't know, cheer me up. Mount Rushmore was carved by a man named Gutzon Borglum. And when he signed the contract, he was actually on the lam. There were warrants out for his arrest in Georgia because he had been carving another monument in the side of a mountain, this one honoring the Confederacy. And that monument was eventually completed. It's Stone Mountain right outside of Atlanta, which is still the world's largest Confederate monument. And Gutzon Borglum was carving it and trying to siphon off the donations. He even joined the Ku Klux Klan when they took control of the project so he could get in better with the money. They eventually fired him because he was too greedy with trying to get his hands on too much of the donations. So that's bad. Fellow Klan members are like, ugh, that guy. So they fire him. He smashed his models to prevent them from hiring somebody else to finish the project. They put out a warrant for his arrest. He goes on the run. and gets back in touch with the businessman in South Dakota who'd been asking him, hey, why don't you carve a few small sculptures of American heroes out here? And he upsold them, essentially. He convinced them, let's turn a whole mountain into a piece. And what we see now is actually unfinished. Borglum lived well on it for the rest of his life, borrowed a whole lot more money, and then he dropped out of a heart attack, and they kind of tidied it up and declared it finished. He actually wanted to carve out the inside of the mountain to put more sculptures of people who wouldn't be on the front and also hold precious American documents like the Declaration of Independence, et cetera, et cetera.
Trump puts a monument of American heroes to somewhere, doesn't he, as I recall?
Yes, which is awfully funny. He has this. He's going to make a garden of American heroes, all of whom have to be carved in a realistic portraiture style. None of this abstract BS. One of the people on the list is Christopher Columbus, whom famously we don't know what he looked like. We don't have any images from the time. So how you're going to create a photorealistic portrait of someone you don't know what it looked like seems a little tough. Around the same time that he canceled a lot of National Endowment for the Humanities grants, he re-brought up this idea, which had first been brooded about during his first administration. So maybe all of the money he took away from researchers and et cetera will soon be displayed in photorealistic fake Columbus or something.
When all these monuments were coming down 5 years ago, there was a school of thought that thought we should leave them up as conversation pieces, as ways to talk about history. And other people just wanted it down because they thought they were celebrating the wrong thing and spreading poisonous ideas in the present. Where do you stand on that? Leave them up or take them down?
Well, I looked at work of people who study what happens if you do try and recontextualize a monument. So there's this idea of retain and explain. Keep a monument up, but put up some signage, put up a counter monument, put up other stuff to say, this is a reminder that we used to believe this shameful thing, we used to honor this horrible person, but we've changed now, it's all good. And what this research showed by surveys of visitors, et cetera, is people are remarkably good at ignoring information that they do not want to hear. Nobody likes cognitive dissonance, so if you go to a site thinking somebody like Thomas Jefferson was a hero, you tour Monticello, you can walk right through exhibitions that are put up to tell you about the hundreds of people he enslaved and come out either having just wiped that experience from your mind, having retained nothing, or having warped the information into something that accorded with your own preconceptions. So the scholar who interviewed people at Monticello after these new exhibitions about the enslaved people there would come out saying things like, oh, I learned that, Thomas Jefferson really gave slaves a chance. He was so good to them. This is not what the message is supposed to be. And I think it's even harder when it comes to a monument. Reptile brain sees something big and beautiful and shiny and elevated and thinks, ooh, that's worthy of honor. That's something important. And reading a couple hundred words on a little plaque, which, by the way, nobody does, is not going to change that emotional impact of a monument.
It's funny. There's this statue in Fort Greene, about a mile from where I sit, of a guy named Fowler. And there's a square named after him. It's Fowler Square. I have no idea who he is, and there's nothing explains who Fowler is. So we have this monuments to people we don't even know.
But I think even those monuments have messages. They're the subconscious visual impression of the city. So, for example, a huge amount of the figural monuments in New York City were put up around the turn of the century when there was a lot of concern about immigration from places that were less, quote-unquote, white. There is a movement to put up a lot of figural sculptures that essentially honor random white dudes. We don't remember who we are, but now we're left with a city filled full of these are the people who are honored. So if you don't look like one of those people, what are you supposed to do? Especially in New York City, Tompkins Square Park is my favorite example, where it is among the most diverse corners of the city, and there's a monument in there who no one has ever heard of, the person it honors, but he voted against the Emancipation Proclamation. That dude is up in our parks, and by the way, the monument looks terrible. It looks like three toddlers in a trench coat. Even the New York Times, when it was put up, insulted it it's not looking very beautiful.
Taking monuments down is one thing, and putting them back up is another. that's a whole different ball of wax.
Well, and what you see, too, is the federal administration can make these statements that have trickle-down effects in local contests. So Stone Mountain has been the focus of advocacy for decades. Finally, a few years ago, the association that runs the park, it's not just a monument, that's just a small part of a huge recreational park that's still the most visited tourist destination in Georgia. So there's an on-site museum about the history of the area and the monuments, which did not mention the Klan, which barely mentioned any of the controversies. Was really pretty lame in terms of actual history. And so that shut down, and there was a bid process that went out, and a new committee formed to revamp the entire museum. And just a few months ago, the Georgia branch of the Sons of the Confederate Veterans sued the Park Association to prevent that new museum from opening. They don't even know it's going to be in the museum, but just the idea that the project said we're going to tell actual history rather than making everything happy-go-lucky, that panicked people enough to sue. And they, in their publicity, in their interviews about it, explicitly referred to Trump's actions as something that encouraged them. The president wants us to tell the honorable version of history, not to bog ourselves down in all of this woke lemmings view of history, so this is why we're suing. And I imagine that kind of encouragement is being felt by all sorts of people in all sorts of fights across the U.S.
That was Erin Thompson, professor of art crime at John Jay College. Her website is artcrimeprof.com, artcrimeprof.com. And now a radical shift of attention to Trump's ludicrous Gaza peace scheme. Mouin Rabbani was on this show last week with an overview of the situation in the wake of multiple diplomatic recognitions of Palestine, a state that does not yet exist. Days later, Trump unleashed his 21-point plan, later reduced to 20, to end the war, making it one of six or seven or however many he claims to have ended. What does it all mean? Here's Mouin Rabbani, who is very gracious about being pressed into service so soon after his last appearance, to tell us. Mouin is the co-editor of the e-zine Jadalia and co-host of its podcast. This peace deal, I mean, it looks like take this Hamas or we'll just blow you even further into smithereens. What is the content? What are the impressions of this deal?
I wouldn't call it a peace deal. It's basically an initiative put forward by the Americans in close coordination with the Israelis, as is always the case. I think a little background here might be useful. This began last week during the United Nations General Assembly when, on the sidelines of that meeting, Trump met with a delegation of pro-Western Arab and Muslim leaders, so a number of Arab states, a number of Muslim states like Turkey, Pakistan, Indonesia, maybe a few others. And these leaders explained to him that the continuation of the Gaza genocide was causing real problems for them. And additionally, that they were increasingly concerned about the regional expansion of what appears to be Israel's forever war. You know, I think the attack on Qatar, which could only have happened if it had been authorized and supported by the U.S., really rattled a lot of them. And they basically said that they would like to find a way for this to end. And on the basis of that, they worked out a 21-point plan, which, at least according to the official story, if you will, was not presented to either the Israelis or Hamas on the understanding that the Americans would bring Israel on board and the Arab and Muslim leaders would ensure that Hamas would accept it. Then, last few days, of course, Air Force Netanyahu landed in Washington, and during his meetings with Trump and his team and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, the plan was reduced to 20 points. All references to the West Bank were removed. There was even an item in the original plan that stated that Israel would no longer conduct attacks on Qatar, and that was removed, and a bunch of other changes were made. the Arabs found out about this and were said, according to various press reports, to be furious and appealed to Trump not to publish the plan, not to announce it. He went ahead and did so anyway in a joint press conference with Netanyahu, where at least from my end, it was impossible to tell who was the American and who was the Israeli. I mean, they sounded identical, both engaged in exactly the same rhetoric. All the old tropes about Israel disengaging from Gaza in 2005 because it was desperate for peace with the Palestinians and all the rest of it. And it's now being put forward as a take-it-or-leave-it plan. And so several questions remain. Netanyahu said that Israel supports the plan, but the Israeli government has yet to formally accept it. The question then becomes, will the Arab and Muslim leaders demand changes to what was announced in Washington, or will they, as many expect, just put their tails between their legs and go to Hamas and say, sorry guys, this is the best we could get, and you now have to accept it, and assuming that they do so, how will Hamas respond? My sense, and again I'm speculating, is that it's going to be very difficult for Hamas to reject this plan, even though the plan basically calls for the total disarmament of Hamas, its dissolution, and all kinds of other conditions. First of all, because of the unified pressure from these Arab and Muslim states. And secondly, because of course the population in the Gaza Strip is desperate for survival. And even though I think many people understand that this will provide at most a pause in the genocide rather than an end to it, and certainly nothing like a political resolution that addresses the underlying reasons for the crisis, I think for many people, well, if we can go even for a week without bombs and artillery shells constantly landing on our heads, if we can have access to food, water, and medicine, that's a lot better than nothing.
But as you say, there's no long-term political solution to any of this. I mean, what's going to happen with 2 million largely homeless Gazans?
Again, it depends on how you look at this initiative. As I said, it's not a peace plan. And it appears to be designed to be rejected by Hamas so that Israel and its apologists can once again get in front of the TV cameras, go on social media and say, see, the Palestinians have rejected another peace plan. They never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity and all the rest of it. But if, as I suspect, Hamas does accept this, at least formally, we should know in the next few days, then the question becomes, what will Israel do? Because according to this plan, all remaining captives in the Gaza Strip and the corpses of Israelis who have been killed since 2023, mainly by Israeli bombings, those are supposed to be released within the first 72 hours of the implementation of this agreement. And my expectation is that once that happens, someone will throw a rock or Israel will manufacture or engineer some kind of violation or provocation and then say deal is off and we'll resume with the full support of the U.S. and with Europe. But to answer your specific question, assuming for the sake of argument that this agreement is implemented, it's never going to lead to a political resolution. The first item of these 20 points is the de-radicalization, not of Israel, but of the Palestinians and the Gaza Strip. A, it doesn't define what de-radicalization is. And so Israel will always be able to say Palestinian society has not yet been fully de-radicalized and therefore we're still stuck in the first phase. That's just for starters. You know, then there is the demilitarization of Hamas. And Israelis could always say, well, there's still a tunnel or a submachine gun somewhere, because it will be Israel with the full support of the U.S. that determines Palestinian compliance. I mean, it's important to recognize this is an agreement that treats Israeli rights over the Palestinians, or rather Israeli claims over the Palestinians, as inalienable rights, and treats the inalienable rights of the Palestinian people as claims that may or may not be addressed at some point in the distant future. The final article of this initiative doesn't recognize a Palestinian right to self-determination, doesn't recognize the right of the Palestinian people to an independent and sovereign Palestinian state. It merely recognizes that Palestinians have an aspiration to self-determination and statehood, as if that's some kind of major revelation that the world was previously unaware of. And so it's very much in the framework of the Oslo process, you know, where Palestinian rights are subordinated to Israeli interests. Israel is the arbiter of the degree to which Palestinians have met their obligations. Anytime Palestinians do meet obligations, new demands are placed on them, and as a result, they continue to live under Israeli domination. That inevitably leads to a crisis, as it did, for example, with the Second Intifada in 2000 or on October 7th, and then the Israelis can sanctimoniously get up and say, see, we don't have a partner for peace. The agreement does say that Israel will not annex or occupy the Gaza Strip. It doesn't say anything about the West Bank, interestingly enough. So on the one hand, it says that. On the other, it doesn't provide any clear provisions for a full and comprehensive Israeli withdrawal from the Gaza Strip. It does say also that Palestinians will not be ethnically cleansed from the Gaza Strip. But again, you know, that's assuming that this agreement is actually going to be implemented over the course of the next 6 or 12 or 18 months. I think everyone is quite rightfully expecting it to fail when Israel will basically say the deal is off, we're resuming our campaign to expel all the Palestinians.
Yeah, I read some accounts that Netanyahu was speaking in Hebrew, giving a press conference in Hebrew, saying, we're never leaving Gaza, which was not rendered in English with quite the same clarity. Is there something to that?
Yes, because, I mean, he didn't even need to say it in Hebrew, because if you look at the maps that accompany the proposal, which could have been drawn by a fifth grader with a crayon.
It was Trump and his Sharpie.
Yes, exactly. It doesn't clarify when and to where Israel will withdraw. It doesn't say that on this date, all Israeli forces will have been fully withdrawn from the entirety of the Gaza Strip. I think Netanyahu was speaking in Hebrew to give an assurance to his constituents, but also perhaps to indicate that even the limited withdrawals that are in the plan won't necessarily come to fruition.
The document itself, which is a remarkably thin document for such a major issue, but that aside, yes, speaks of a reconstruction authority headed and chaired. Trump will never use one word, but he can use two, by Trump himself. Is there anything to this authority?
Well, again, the underlying question is whether one believes all this is actually going to be implemented. Assuming for the sake of argument that it does, one of the major changes made in this plan after Netanyahu gave Trump and his entourage an earful is that the administration of the Gaza Strip will no longer be a Palestinian affair. Trump is a titular head of it, but the actual colonial viceroy here is none other than Tony Blair, who did such a wonderful job in Iraq. And basically, the Gaza Strip is being transformed into a protectorate that is fully disjointed from the West Bank. And this is a key issue because, of course, the United States is expecting to implement all of this with other people's money and other people's troops. The Arab and Muslim leaders, more informally at least, pledged that they would supply the funds and they would supply the troops of the stabilization force, but on the understanding that they were doing so to assist a revival of Palestinian authority control over the Gaza Strip as part of an irreversible process leading definitively towards an independent Palestinian state. That is now all off the table. So the question becomes, will these states still be willing to play their assigned role after Palestinian governance has been replaced by Blair's scheme?
And you mentioned the West Bank. What about that?
This is now a plan exclusively for the Gaza Strip. The only parts that really concern the West Bank are those items that talk about the Palestinian Authority. And a whole list of homework assignments have been placed before the Palestinian Authority, primarily to ensure that they can never be met. And it is only when all these assignments have been completed to Washington and Israel's satisfaction, i.e. never, that the Palestinian Authority will be permitted to play a role in the Gaza Strip.
The Palestinian Authority is like a bankrupt force politically, isn't it?
It's not only bankrupt politically, it's now increasingly bankrupt economically as well, because Israel is refusing to transfer the taxes and fees that it collects on behalf of the PA at its own insistence, I should add. It's refusing to transfer these to the Palestinian Authority. You know, the Palestinian Authority was established as an interim institution. It was never supposed to last more than 5 years, and it was established as a subordinate agency of the PLO. In practice, the PLO has become a subordinate agency of the PA, and the PA is now playing the primary role in Palestinian national politics. But it has a real credibility and legitimacy problem. And even more importantly than that, its leader, Mahmoud Abbas, who is now, I think, in the 20th year of his 4-year term, has approval ratings that are basically rock bottom. He's seen as illegitimate, irrelevant. And so the question becomes, can this body be revived? And if so, how should it be revived? And what role can or should there be for political movements like Hamas and Islamic Jihad that are not part of the PLO in such a revival? I think most Palestinian analysts would say that the proper way to go about this is to seek a revival of the PLO to make it more credible, to make it genuinely national once again. And that can only be done by the integration of Hamas and Islamic Jihad and a larger role for the Palestinian diaspora. But the Trump plan basically nixes that from the outset.
And finally, any thoughts on Jared Kushner's deal-making with Qatar, the UAE, and Saudi Arabia? This is looking really unseemly.
Well, it's not only Kushner, it's also Blair, who basically wants to test run all kinds of digital surveillance and governance programs in the West Bank, in the Gaza Strip, which he's been a champion of, and which he has now also been lobbying the British government to implement in the UK. And he's apparently very close with Larry Ellison, who will be known to you as the current owner of TikTok, or rather the father of the current owner of TikTok. Kushner, it is said, sees Gaza as prime real estate and an opportunity to make even more money. Well, I don't dispute that. I think the real agenda here is making the Gaza Strip safe for Israel and making it safe for Israel by eliminating the Palestinian National Movement and eliminating the Palestinians from Gaza as far as possible.
That was Mouin Rabbani, co-editor of Jadalia, an e-zine on Middle Eastern affairs. The reference to Jared Kushner's deal-making principally concerns his role in a buyout of Electronic Arts, the video game maker, with much of the money coming from Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund. The Trump administration rejects any suggestion that the deal, which requires U.S. government approval, had anything to do with Jared being Donald's son-in-law. Speaking of TikTok, word of the social media is that the platform is already censoring material critical of Israel and AIPAC. Under Trump, control of the media looks now to be a joint venture of the public and private sectors. It always has been, of course, but this takes it up a few notches. Notably, Larry Ellison, the second richest person in the world, whom Trump describes as an amazing man, an amazing business person, and sort of the CEO of everything, now controls, along with his son David, Paramount, parent of CBS, and David is now the master of TikTok, safely out of the hands of the evil Chinese, and now in the hands of a Zionist mogul. As for Larry, who also has his eye on Warner, parent of HBO and CNN, Larry said last year, of our surveillance camera observed an AI-guided future, citizens will be on their best behavior because we are constantly recording and reporting everything that is going on. Larry has just made Barry Weiss, the reactionary Zionist pseudo-journalist, beloved of reactionary moguls everywhere, editor-in-chief of CBS. Good thing its audience is dwindling. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after musical break.
Peace, love, unity, respect.
and some of Plur, Peace, Love, Unity, Respect, by T-78, the stage name of the Italian producer Manuele Tessarolo, which sounds oddly like a Soviet tank, but is shared with a video game Tank Destroyer. It was remixed by Amelie Lenz. It's looking like Zoran Mamdani is going to be the next mayor of New York. Who is he, and what does it all mean? Here's Theodore Ham, Ted to his friends, who is just out with a political biography called Run, Zoran, Run, from Or Books. Zoran, as everyone in the city calls him, was born in Uganda, the son of the academic Mahmoud Mamdani and filmmaker Mira Nair. He spent his first 5 years in Kampala, then moved to Cape Town when his father got a teaching job there. A couple of years later, his father got a professorship at Columbia, and he became a New Yorker. He bounced around for much of his 20s, including stints as a rapper and a housing counselor, and then got bitten by the politics bug when he managed journalist Ross Barkin's failed 2018 campaign for the state Senate. Soon after, he ran for state assembly on the DSA ticket. DSA, which has supported his campaigns from the first, has been crucial to his success. I'll let Ted Ham pick it up from there. Ted is a professor of journalism at St. Joseph's University in Brooklyn and writes extensively about New York politics.
So he comes to Bay Ridge, and he was going back and forth, living in Morningside Heights in 2017, and going back and forth to Bay Ridge, which is a long, long ride. And 2017 was widely known as the summer of hell here in New York City. The subway system was experiencing countless, countless delays. That was compounded for Zoran because he has a strong case of claustrophobia. And to be on a subway car when you're claustrophobic compounds the problem, right? But the way he dealt with it was by talking to people. So he would tell them, you know, I'm experiencing an episode. Will you talk to me? He said people were very understanding, and they just discussed whatever it might be, the weather or events of the day.
Let's talk about the cornerstones of his platform, the three most famous ones, freeze the rent, free buses, and universal child care. And could add a fourth, city-run grocery stores, which have evoked the wackiest opposition, you know, Soviet-style retailing. Talk about the platform just for a bit.
Freeze the rent, as I mentioned, was something that evolved or was derived from the de Blasio era, when his rent guidelines board, which oversees rent stabilization, rent-controlled apartments program, he did it three times, I believe, freezing the rent. And that's something that the NYC DSA immediately started advocating when Eric Adams started raising the rent. So that just became the signature component of his platform. He ran the marathon twice, 2022 and 2024, and as he was launching his campaign, and he was wearing a Freeze the Rent shirt, right? So it just kind of was already there from the get-go. Then you had the universal child care. That was something that was in play in the 2021 primary with Maya Wiley, who was the most progressive of the many candidates in that race. So that's not wholly original. It's also related to universal pre-K, right, in terms of pre-K is good for students, young students' educations, but it's also excellent for parents because it's basically child care, right? So it saves parents a lot of money. That was the origins of child care. And then you had fast and free buses. That was linked to a pilot program that he and a fellow state legislator from the Astoria area, Mike Gennaris, they had rolled that out with great success over the last couple of years in the city. So it's expanding on that. And he makes a point to say that we are incorporating policies that have been tried out in other places too, right? So he is arguing against New York City exceptionalism. We typically see things as if we made it work in New York, that's the best policy, or that's how we done it in New York. We don't need to listen to what's happening in Denver or Eugene, Oregon. Something that didn't get a lot of attention was his proposals on policing. That didn't get a lot of attention in the primary, but that has been added to the mix in the general election. We've seen that over the last several weeks. And then you mentioned city-run grocery stores. Well, that's something that there's already variations of that, but it's so obvious that there's a need for it. His main detractor on the issue is the grocery store magnate, John Catsimatidis, this chain, Big Apple chain as it's called, the supermarkets. If you look at the map in Manhattan, they don't even have any locations. They have about 30 locations. None are above 110th Street in Manhattan, right? And that's where working class, poor folks live, uptown, right? The larger market, the free market, is not addressing the problems of food deserts in low-income neighborhoods and so on. So, yes, as you said, there's a lot of clamor about, you know, this is Soviet-style rationing and all this other stuff, but the reality is that the free market, in terms of supermarket and grocery stores, has not addressed the problem, has created the problem.
He's just proposing like one per borough, right? It's not like mass chains of municipally owned groceries.
Right. So it's hard. That one per borough is going to undermine profit margins for John Catsimatidis and others.
But these guys are scared of the threat of a good example, as Noam Chomsky used to say. You mentioned this, but let's talk about that a little more. The policing. I mean, the mainstream and the right have given him a hard time about cops and jails. He was once identified with defunding the police. And he's proposed this Department of Community Safety to take on some of the responsibility of the cops. So, yeah, what's the law and order platform?
The law and order candidates are Cuomo, Eric Adams, and the Republican, Curtis Sliwa. But they just are basically proposing the old line crackdown on low-level offenses, quality of life policing, all the same stuff we've been hearing for and seeing for the last several decades. Zoran worked on the Tiffany Caban's campaign for Queens DA in 2019, where she started proposing alternatives to policing. She was actually an abolitionist, but that's a very, very radical position. But she was proposing things that were mental health interventions and things like that that he has since built on and made a part of his platform. And it's been there from day one as well. So it just didn't get a lot of attention in the primary. But now that he has these antagonists who are from the law and order crowd, Cuomo, Adams, and Sliwa, they're just hammering away whatever they can find. They've tried to make decriminalization of sex work one of their main arguments against Mamdani, saying he's supported it while in the state assembly and so on. But, you know, it just doesn't seem to be working. There was a Times poll taken in the first week of September after several weeks of these slams about he wants to legalize prostitution, all this stuff. And the Times polls showed that Mamdani and Cuomo were about even in terms of which candidate voters saw as best suited to handle crime, right? I wouldn't say that there's been a sea change in the way crime is viewed in the city, but it does seem like he has a groundswell of support to push forward with his Department of Community Safety, which is oriented around a public health approach, right? Saying we need mental health interventions, people in crisis. Emotionally disturbed people don't always need cops showing up and escalating the situations, and there's been far too many tragedies that have occurred as a result of that. And many police seem to be saying similar things too, right? Those are not what they've signed up for, to try to handle people's distress in need like that, right? They're there to fight violent crimes and so on. After several weeks of Cuomo and Adams attacking Mamdani on his positions regarding decriminalizing sex work, right? That's not the same as fully legalizing it. That after several weeks of that, the Times poll in early September came out and said, or showed that 30% of New York voters said Mamdani is the best candidate to handle crime, and 29% said Cuomo, right? And the rest were going for a mix of Sliwa, Adams.
That was a really surprising result, because on that particular issue, when they're isolating individual issues, you would have thought that Cuomo might have gotten a more resounding vote on behalf of the law and order, but it didn't even work in that sphere. So it looks like he's likely to win. The betting markets show that. It's not a lock. Adams could withdraw and his votes go to Cuomo. So, you know, there are a whole lot of uncertainties between now and election day. But what kind of odds would you give for him winning?
Well, the New York Times the other day used the term, appears to be on a glide path to victory. So I don't know.
If the New York Times says it, it must be true.
I think it looks pretty good. I mean, because of the divided field, because he has become such an international star, there's a lot of people out that I've spoken to, came to events that we did and so on, and spoke to yesterday at the Brooklyn Book Festival, who are older people, like more, we would think they were more typical standard Democrats, liberals maybe, but not leftists. But, you know, everyone just seemed excited about this new era. And I think he has a lot of support across demographics at this point. Obviously, some groups of voters were more influential than other, more representative of his of his coalition than others in the primary, but I think that's expanded considerably. And he's getting support from many mainstream Democrats, except per the two most powerful Democrats who happen to both be from Brooklyn, Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader and the leader of the Democrats in the House. But he doesn't need their support at this point. Huge swaths of the electorate are backing him, and I don't think he needs these major players to, doesn't matter but at this point what they do.
Jeffries doesn't seem to understand that Zohran carried his district, which is my district. If I were Jeffries, I'd be a little worried about my own political future, since he's missing this vote.
As you said, the district went 12% for Mamdani over Cuomo, 56-44 roughly, or something to that effect. And there's a NYC DSA state senator, Jabari Brisport, who's very close to Zohran, close ally, and, you know, in the same district, and it seems like Hakeem is ignoring that. I don't know exactly what, but obviously Jabari Brisport would have a very good chance at unseating the most powerful Democrat in the House, most nationally, because he was not paying attention to what was happening on the streets of his own district.
Okay, so let's assume he wins. He will face some very serious challenges. One is that he's young. He doesn't have a whole lot of experience. Some of his legislative colleagues thought he might be getting ahead of himself with this run. He has no managerial experience to speak of. He will face the relentless hostility of the Post, the real estate world, the NYPD, the Zionists. Can he handle it?
I think what we saw in the primary is a level of vitriol and animosity of all kinds from all directions, particularly about Israel, but also about more mundane things like grocery stores, city-run grocery stores, right? So, you know, he really showed that he could handle it and incur heavy fire daily, hourly, right, in May and into June. And increasingly, he fought it off and his stature grew. I think there's an extent to which when people are the object of so much contempt that New Yorkers say, well, why does everyone hate this guy so much? Maybe it's because he's doing something that they don't want. And, you know, that all of the attacks on Israel in particular, but some of the stuff about socialism or and the economy and lack of management experience, you know, people just said, well, let's give this guy a shot. You know, if they hate him so much, it must be all right. But that doesn't tell us what might happen if and when he takes office. But he did show that he could run a massive campaign with 50,000 volunteers knocking on 1.6 million doors across the city to show that, you know, this was a huge, complex operation, and he handled it with, you know, considerable skill and showed his management chops in that regard. But what he's doing is saying, what he's been saying is he's going to speak to people, and he has been speaking to people who are veteran hands in city government, people who've been deputy mayors and handled various agencies and so on. His appointees will not all be his generation. I'm sure there's going to be a mix of different people that he's going to lead his administration. I'm confident that he will be very demanding of the people he hires. He wants to make, and he'll need them to make sure that they're all on board with whatever innovations he wants to push forward in various agencies, right? So that's a challenge because older, experienced people who handled various agencies, they want to do things the way they've known it for the last several decades. But he's got to make sure they're on board with the changes he wants to see. So the police commissioner has to be someone who's willing to allow for the Department of Community Safety to be created and essentially cede some power from the NYPD to this new department that's taking a completely different approach, and so on. So, you know, he's got to make sure that the commissioner is someone who's aligned with his vision.
We recorded the bulk of this interview on September 22nd. 6 days later, Eric Adams dropped out of the race. Here's a postscript on his withdrawal we recorded on October 1st. Eric Adams dropped out. What does it all mean? He pulled out too late to be deleted from the ballot, so I guess people could still vote for him if they feel like it. Hard to imagine anybody would want to, but that's another story. He stopped campaigning. What effect will all this have on the outcome?
Well, if you look at the poll numbers, Eric Adams was only getting about 10%, and Cuomo's down by 20%. So if Cuomo got all of Eric Adams' votes, that would still leave Cuomo down by 10%. Now, I don't really think that all of Eric Adams' voters are going to come out for Cuomo, because Eric Adams called Cuomo a snake and a liar.
One of the most truthful statements he ever uttered.
Exactly. And I also think many of Eric Adams' voters will stay home. Some may even vote for Curtis Sliwa because they're older and they've been around for a while. And they like people who've been around for a while. So, you know, I don't think it's a game changer in any respect.
So what can we say about Adams' tenure? I saw a headline in the Real Deal, a real estate trade publication the other day, that lamented his real estate legacy probably won't be sufficiently appreciated, which made me laugh. But what did he accomplish in that all-important sphere and elsewhere? What is the legacy of Eric Adams, if any?
In his farewell address on Sunday afternoon, released on Sunday afternoon from Gracie Mansion, he touted some accomplishments that I don't think would stand up to fact-checking. He claims that he built more housing than any other mayoral administration ever, and I don't think that stands the test of scrutiny because he was only in for 4 years, right? Bloomberg and Ed Koch were in for 12 years. So, yeah, I don't really see what his legacy – I mean, I think the most obvious – part of his legacy is negative, right? Raising rents 12% over 4 years in rent-stabilized housing, that created an opening for Mamdani to capitalize on, right? And pledging a rent freeze in response to that significant spike over 4 years of Eric Adams, that was a winning issue for Mamdani. So, I don't really see, he's done some minor stuff, but the things that he's claiming, Eric Adams, it's really just kind of empty rhetoric.
Host Theodore Ham, a.k.a. Ted, author of Run, Zoran, Run, just out for more books. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go at this, another remix by Amelie Lenz, this of Voices in My Head by R.G., Son of Sun and Anima. Till next week, bye.
I know I should sleep, but the voices in my head go, voices in my head go, voices in my head go. I know I should sleep, but the voices in my head go, voices in my head go, voices in my head go. I know I should sleep, but the voices in my head go. But the voices in my head go, 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 go.